Can I get a roll call, please?
Yes. Hero?
Yes.
Bagai?
Yes.
Blazik?
Yes.
Brady? Brownstein?
Yes.
Christensen?
It's an absolute pleasure.
Lout?
Yes.
Snell?
Here.
And Dr. Beanstalk and Dr. German are absent.
Thank you, Sherry. Moving on to agenda item number two, review, discussion, and possible action on committee meeting minutes. I'll make a motion that we approve the open session minutes from the August 2nd committee meeting.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Let's get a roll call, Sherry.
Sorry, you caught me off guard on that one. Hero?
Yes.
Bagai?
Yes.
Blazik?
Yes.
Brownstein?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Lout?
Yes.
Snell?
Yes.
Motion passes, none opposed. Notice of proposed rulemaking. Jessica, do we have you online? Ryan, do we know if Jessica is on?
It looks like she is.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, we can hear you now. How are you doing?
Hi, sorry about that. I'm well, thank you.
Great, thank you for being here. Jessica, I'll turn it over to you now.
Okay, sure. Give me 1 second. Okay, so from our last meeting, this is where we stopped. We are in moderate sedation, and we are under the section relating to obtaining a mobile section 1302 permit. It looks like we got through the first requirement, but we stopped before we got to the second requirement. So I don't know if you want to start with the first requirement just to get our bearings and then move forward, or if you want to jump right into subsection B.
Any committee members have suggestions? I'd say maybe we just jump right in.
Okay, so if we are looking at subsection B, then all we're changing is the reference. I'm assuming that no one has any issues with that. We'll move on to C, which the suggestion was to remove C.
Yeah, just background on what C was there was a time when the committee was discussing that every office, to kind of give the board an understanding of everywhere that anesthesia and sedation was being provided in the state, that even with a mobile permit holder, that the office, or the dentist at the office, has a permit, you know, whether it be a 1304 or higher, to allow a mobile permit holder to come in. That was a discussion at a time that the committee decided to not continue in that direction. So with that, I think we can delete that part. Unless that is a direction the committee wants to still discuss.
Dr. Blazik?
Yeah. I was wondering, and this is kind of like with Ollie's comment there, and you know, I would suggest that, you know, it can be removed. But something has happened to me just twice in the past month regarding mobile permit issues, and one is extremely egregious. And why I want to bring it up in this forum, because I do believe, in my mind, the mobile permit is truly for somebody such as Ollie or Dr. Brady or Dr. Brownstein Dr. Snell, where they truly kind of carry their equipment from office to office. And whenever I do an evaluation on someone like that, it's pretty obvious that they're a mobile provider. and that everything they have goes with them from office to office. And I've done two recent mobile permits. One's coming up where the provider literally told me, well, I'm not even going to work out of that office. I just want to do my exam there. And then I'm going to get my mobile permit and then just kind of travel around and do what I want to do. And I think there's a real problem in that. One, like I want to fail them right away because I think that's not a good way to practice anesthesia, and I'm probably not allowed to do that. But two, I really think the board is opening themselves up for litigation because, again, I believe the intent of the statutes is to, we are saying that this office is a safe area to provide anesthesia, and we're hopefully having a safe and talented provider. But for these past two permit applications to be so egregious in telling me, well, I'm not even going to work here, so whatever, just give me a permit and I'm going to go where I want. And I know the only reason we really did this was because we want to make it easier, I guess, for guys to not have to pay a permit fee every time. They just pay the one mobile permit fee. But I think somewhere in this statute, I think we should have in there that says, look, the individual has a preponderance of evidence that they are truly a mobile provider, you know, much like Ali does and he does. And I know Dr. Brownstein, he's been in my office. He does. He's got his cart, his kit, everything goes with him, as opposed to relying on an office to ensure that the oxygen is there and the emergency drugs are there or whatever. That's what we're doing when we give these permits to people who want to apply for a mobile permit.
Are we able to maybe remedy that by quantifying the amount of offices they're going to and base the type of permit off that? Dr. Caputo, you got your hand up and you're shaking your head. You want to go ahead?
Thanks. Sorry about
that. And I'll clarify my question just before you start, Dr. Caputo. Meaning, if a 1301 permit holder, a prospective permit holder, says, look, I only go to these two offices, so in that regard, I don't need a mobile permit, or I go to four or more and they're trying to do it without a mobile permit, maybe that changes what they're able to apply for. But Dr. Caputo, I'll let you speak.
Well, I'll start by some historical information. When we changed the rules in 2013, I actually wrote the language for the mobile permit provider. And one of the things that was important to the board at the time, and my hope is that it still is important, is that the permit is for the person that's administering the sedation and anesthesia versus the office. So we weren't permitting the office, we were permitting the permit holder or the dentist. And I think that's a very important distinction. And I think one of the challenges that I see happening within the committee, and it's the same challenge that's affected other committees, it's not unique, but there's a real strong push to regulate safety. And I think that's a really hard thing to do. And I actually think that by increasing the requirements or putting certain identifiers on those requirements, that puts the board in a greater litigation situation than decreasing those sorts of things. At the end of the day, you can't regulate safety. And it really shouldn't matter whether the person's a mobile provider or not. What should matter is that the person that is administering sedation or anesthesia at whatever level they're trained is doing it according to their level of training. And that's it. It shouldn't matter how many offices they go to. It shouldn't matter where they go to. It shouldn't matter what's there when they get there. What should matter is that that provider knows that these systems have to be in place. And if they're not in place, they should not be administering sedation or anesthesia. They're accepting responsibility for the conduct of the procedure. And I don't think regulations are going to get you there. I think they just become more confounding and they actually become more restrictive. So
I think ultimately, really the rules in some way should say that when a level of sedation or anesthesia is being administered at the office, the person administering it, if they're a dentist, is responsible for the conduct of that procedure. If they are bringing somebody in their into their office, whether it's a CRNA or a physician, that dentist needs to assume a level of responsibility for the conduct of that procedure. Because at the end of the day, the board has no regulatory control over non-dentist license holders or providers that may come into that person's office. So that dentist really has to be the one that carries some level of responsibility, because the patient is looking to the dentist as the person that's going to take care of them. And if the dentist brings somebody in, then the patient's expectation is that that dentist is doing so knowing that that person's capable. So it really becomes a responsibility of the dentist. And I don't think a regulation is going to get you there. But I'd be careful about putting any type of limitation on the number of offices. And I certainly would be careful about saying that you have to be a mobile provider in order to provide mobile anesthesia. I mean, I function in all sorts of capacities, and I go to offices where I have everything set up and ready to go. I don't bring anything. I have other offices where I bring everything. And at the end of the day, the conduct of the procedure is dependent on me and my skill and capability and what I know I should have in place. So I just kind of would have you guys think about that.
Thank you, Dr. Pluto. Go ahead, Dr. Blasey. You're on mute, Dr. Blasey.
You're muted, Randy.
I appreciate Dr. Caputo's input, and especially his historical evidence there about how it was created. And, you know, trust me, I remember when that occurred and how that was came out of the last statute review and modification. But I would have to ask then, there are other entities that do monitor, you know, hospitals and surgery centers and how their anesthetic is not necessarily delivered, but that things are delivered safely. And my second point would be, I'm not sure of the last time that you've done an evaluation, Dr. Caputo, but I'm going to tell you, in the past 10 years, it's changed dramatically in the number of just general dentists that want to get into this game. And it's when I go there to do the reviews, it's a bit scary. Like, I would not want my family to go there and have anesthesia, whether that dentist is responsible or not. And I may be wrong, but I thought that was the main charge of the board, is that we are there for patient safety.
So great points. Jessica, you want to kind of bring us back into, you know, the substance of the rulemaking we're on, and let's kind of get specific on that discussion.
Sure. So what I'm hearing is that we're still comfortable with removing C from number 4. If the dentist performing the procedure at the dental office or dental clinic holds a valid Section 1301 permit, Section 1302 permit, Section 1303 permit, or Section 1304 permit. We're still comfortable removing that language.
I would agree with that.
At this point, we're not that comfortable with it.
Okay.
This is Dr. Snell. I don't see in C, Dr. Blaze, when you say we're not that comfortable with it, what do you see in C that you would like to keep? Because to me, that looks like it's more like what Ali was saying, where a long time ago the suggestion was made to have some, the office have submit some paperwork or something. I think that's what that was in line with. And to me, we've moved past that. So C in and of itself doesn't apply. If we want to discuss more of the mobile permits, I'm okay with that. But as Jessica's question to C, I don't see that that's very relevant.
Well, I think it hinges on what we decide to do with 1304 permit. So I that's when I think when we get to that aspect, the 1304 permit and how we move forward with that, that will then dictate whether or not C comes out. That's how I feel.
Mr. Bagai.
Yeah, so I just want to kind of come back because I feel like we kind of maybe spun down a little bit of a rabbit hole on this one. I wrote this sentence. This isn't part of the normal rules, right? I wrote this sentence when we were talking about that every office that provides anesthesia services has to have a permit. So what that would mean is right now, Dr. Caputo, Dr. Brady, other dentist anesthesiologists, oral surgeons on the call, anybody, Dr. Snell, anybody that has a mobile permit and goes to another office, that office also has to have a permit. So that's what this sentence was for. And that the reason I wrote it was at that time, the kind of will of the committee seemed to be that every office should have a permit so that the dental board knows every office in the state where anesthesia is being administered. So I think the question is that still something that my impression was that the committee doesn't really feel that way anymore. But if that's still something that the committee wants to discuss, you know, it's not just deleting this sentence. It's kind of adding that sentence to all of the other pieces. So I personally don't feel strongly one way or the other. But that's what that sentence is all about.
Thank you, Mr. Regatta. At 2:47, Dr. Brady signed in. Dr. Brady, you're with us, correct?
I'm with you guys. Thank you. Sorry for my delay.
Thank you. Dr. Snell, I'm going to get to you just one comment. I mean, the best thing to keep this moving may be to remove it, and then when we get to the 1304 discussion, well, you know, Jessica, I would leave it up to you, I guess. If there's a chance when we get into the 1304 discussion that we may want to add language back into previous sections we've discussed, would you rather leave that language that is in there tentatively now or remove it and then address it once we get there?
So I'm just trying to wrap my head around, because mobile permits, right, are no different than the regular permit. The only difference is that it says that it's a mobile permit when they obtain it, right? So I would think that the goal would be that we want to make sure that they are, in fact, meeting the requirements to get the 1302 permit to begin with. And then in addition to that, we want to say that if they want to have a mobile permit, they also have to do this, which is, you know, complete an affidavit that the equipment and the supplies are there. So I'm kind of leaning towards leaving this language in there for now, and possibly coming back to it, because I don't want to, I want to make sure that the mobile permit is still requiring the same hurdles that the regular 1302 permit is requiring, if that makes sense.
Okay, Dr. Snell, then Mr. Begay.
So I have a similar question, Anthony, that you just posed. And Jessica probably answered it. I was thinking it seems like a lot of contingencies we've gone through are on this 1304, so I would take it out, and then when we do the 1304, if it impacts previous things, put back in. But Jessica obviously is better at rule writing than I am, so I would defer to that if she thinks it's better to leave it in. I guess one more thing. The permitting the facility, I have real issues with that. I agree with Dr. Caputo that in every other realm of these rules, we're permitting an individual and supplies that are in the facility, but it's still the individual that we're permitting, whether it's mobile or not. So to make a facility, just because someone's mobile, will have an extra permit or paperwork or whatever, to me that I don't understand how it's going to help safety, access to care, any other thing that we're trying to do on this committee. So
great, thank you. Ollie?
Yeah, sorry, I'm trying to add a little bit more clarity to this, because really that sentence has very little to do with section 1304, right? Because for people like me or physician anesthesiologist to go to an office, the office must have a 1301, 2, 3, or 4. This is really pertaining, and the reason why it's in this having a mobile section is that if this sentence stayed, someone who has a mobile permit, when they go to another office, they need to make sure the dentist at the office they're going to also has a permit, right? So it doesn't really pertain all that much to 1304. It just would mean that, you know, some clients that Dr. Brady has right now that have no permit and they utilize his mobile permit right now would need to go and obtain their own 1304 permit.
Susie.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Susie, go ahead. You got your hand up.
So with the with any of the permits, if they want to do a mobile permit, they sign an affidavit that says that they are going to ensure that the office has the emergency drugs, the emergency equipment, maintains a staff of supervised personnel, holds CPR cards. So they sign an affidavit essentially putting the burden on them to be sure that the emergency equipment and supplies and emergency people are on hand.
Thank you, Susie. Yeah. Dr. Glazer.
So here's my question to the committee based on the evaluation I'm about ready to do. Why don't I just invite all the applicants to my office and let them put a patient to sleep in my office with my stuff and my staff and then say, okay, guys, you're on your own. Just sign an affidavit and go wherever you want. Because that's essentially what this doctor wants me to do. He admitted to me, he goes, I will never practice in the office I'm doing the exam at. And I'm just going to go other places around the state and start providing anesthesia. So why don't I just have him do the exam in my office? It's easier for me to do it right here. I don't have to go somewhere. And I'll just pass my own office. That's essentially what we're saying we want to do. And I know it's off topic here, but I'm hot about it because I don't like that this provider wants to do that. That, you know.
I don't think it's off topic at all.
So normally at this point with the robust discussion like this, I'd move to a vote, but I truthfully, I'm not sure what we would be voting on here. I would kind of defer to Jessica and say, if it's better for now to leave it in until we get to the portion of the rulemaking that is really on point for this discussion, because it's a great discussion. Let's just leave it, move forward, and make sure to dive into this at the appropriate point in rule section, if that sounds okay to everybody.
Yes, that sounds great.
Okay. Then Jessica, let's move forward.
Okay. So that brings us to subsection G. A section 1302 permit holder shall keep a moderate sedation record for each sedation procedure that, one, includes the following entries: preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative pulse oximeter documentation, preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative blood pressure and vital sign documentation, list of all medications given with dosage, time, intervals, route, and site of administration, type of catheter or portal with gauge, indicate nothing by mouth or time of last intake of food or water, consent form, time of discharge and status, including name of escort, and two, may include preoperative and postoperative electrocardiograph report. I have a question here in the margins, which probably came from another rule, because I promise I have no idea what all of this stuff is and would not be able to come up with it by myself. But what about any ventilation report?
So I think last meeting we voted and decided on requiring 1302 permit holders to monitor ventilation via either a precordial stethoscope or end-tidal CO2. So I think the question here is, do we need to list that ventilation monitoring needs to be recorded in this anesthesia record? But somebody correct me if I'm wrong. Dr. Snell?
I believe that's where that came from, Anthony. Right at the end of the meeting, you had spoken up and said something about that. My question is, how do you record a precordial stethoscope reading? You're just listening. So is it just a box that someone marks and says, I'm using it? Or, because if you use even the, it's like an EKG, right? And which is another thing that I want to talk about, but unless someone has the ability to print off, and what are we going to print off? Just a minute section? Do you want to print off the whole hour? So I don't really see how those types of things are, how do you record other than you say I did it or I didn't do it?
Dr. Brady?
I think one way of recording that is you're recording respiration rates. You're recording whether there's spontaneously ventilation or assisted ventilation or being ventilated. But, I mean, that's getting into a lot of the details. I don't know if that's really necessary to help. I mean, you continuously are monitoring the patient for breathing and adequate ventilation and oxygenation.
Thanks, Dr. Brady. Dr. Blazek?
Yeah, and I thought, Dr. Snell, I thought that you would just have a checkbox that either you used, you know, precordial or you used a capnography. And certainly, you know, you're monitoring. And I apologize for not looking. I'm reading the document here and talking to you guys. But, you know, you have the pulse oximetry monitored throughout. And I think most monitors now, at the end, you press print, and it will actually print, you know, your vital signs at every 5 minutes, and on there it will show, you know, we typically keep that in the record. So that's kind of my thought. It would be just a checkbox is how you would do that.
Dr. Lout? And then,
you know, this might be a little bit off the topic, but I think some section of the rules we had noted things like ASA classification, weight, age. Do we want to include that in this section as well? Just for consistency with other parts of the rules.
Dr. Snell, then Dr. Brady.
So I'm just wondering that later on it's going to talk about needing to have oxygen on the patient, needing to use a new IV line and a new IV bag. Are we going to put check marks saying that we did all that stuff on the forms as well? I think at some point we just need to say this is what you're supposed to have and let people know they're supposed to have it. I mean, there's lots of things we're supposed to have. Are we going to need a checkbox on the record to state that I have all of this stuff on every single record? I mean, that seems very onerous to put on there.
Dr. Brady?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of is an interesting concept as a whole, because one of the things that we were tasked with is looking at the MH and how that role plays with different general anesthesia providers as far as what drugs to supply. But when you really dive into it, in one hand, it's very generic because it's saying emergency drugs. But when it comes to equipment, it spells out everything. But in the drugs in itself, the evaluation form at that point spells out a lot of the drugs that they are looking for. In one sense, it seems like you're more general in the rules and regs, but then you have the evaluation form more specified. It gives flexibility to the board to be able to adapt to things that are changing and not go through a full rules and regs revision. So I'm listening to what Heath is saying on this, but you know, I think that's more a collective thought of things when it comes to that.
Jessica?
So correct me if I'm wrong, but because you are including and requiring the blood pressure, the vital signs, as well as the pulse oximeter, I mean, is there anything in a ventilation report that's going to provide more information than those things already do? I mean, those things would show that they're getting the oxygen that they need, right? And forgive me for not being more familiar with these processes.
Ali?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to what Dr. Snell was saying regarding, you know, it should just be kind of the standard, but so why do we have to document it on top? I mean, just from a medical legal standpoint, right, if you don't document it, it didn't happen. So having something as simple as a checkbox to say, yes, there was a precordial stethoscope placed. Otherwise, if there's an event and it gets looked at, and you say, of course, I had a precordial stethoscope, but there's nothing documented. I mean, that in my mind, that's why you document. Because otherwise, we wouldn't document anything, right? Otherwise, we would just say, well, of course we did. We did the appropriate and good care, and the patient's fine, but what happens when the patient's not fine?
Heath, go ahead.
I don't disagree that it's good medical legal advice to document and to take good notes, but I think where does the rule and statute end and the ability for a doctor to make a decision on what they want to include in their notes, where does that start for the provider? Like you can make every single little regulation and rule that you have to write notes this way, you have to use the SOAP format, you have to do this, but I just, that seems really, really, really onerous to me to put that level of legislation and rules on providers. If the rule is you're supposed to have pulse oximeter or capnography, it's already in there, you're supposed to have it. If the rule says you're supposed to have oxygen on the patient, you're supposed to have it. If the rule says you're supposed to use a new IV infusion line and bag, you're supposed to do that. And it would be good practice, I agree, to mark in your notes that you've done those things from a medical legal standpoint. But is that our job to regulate to that small, minute degree that there's got to be checkboxes for all those things on someone's notes?
So for me, either we keep A through G under one and add in preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative ventilation monitoring, however that wants to be worded, or we don't have any of it. But I think for completion's sake, if we're going to require that end tidal or ventilation is being monitored, just as pulse ox, ECG, and blood pressure, then we should add it in here or disregard all of it. So let's vote on it. And I guess my first motion would be just that we add in another subsection here that says ventilation is being monitored. So I'll make that motion.
Well, Dr. Hero, I think we do have that above, that ventilation is monitored. What this is specifically saying is you have a record of it.
Right. Yeah. I'm not making a motion to on the exact specific language, but let's just see where we are as a committee on if it needs to be documented or not.
Okay.
So we have a motion on the table.
Do we have a second?
Can we get a second and then go into, and then we can have a discussion?
Christensen seconds.
Thank you, Dr. Christensen. So, again, I think if right here we're going to list that pulse ox needs to be documented, that blood pressure needs to be documented, that EKG needs to be documented, in my mind, to complete it, we should be documenting end tidal or respiratory rate. Or just don't require any of this to be documented. But I'm just making a motion to kind of keep things moving along. I'll let you guys discuss it.
This is Christensen. It seems like an easy documentation to me. A checkbox. These are medical legal documents, and I think we need to, as Ali stated before, we should confirm what we've done and for all to see that it happened.
Dr. Blazik and then Dr. Brady.
Yeah, I was just going to basically echo the same thing that Eddie said. I don't think there's a ding or darn anesthesia record I have completed through all my residency and even in my office that doesn't have a checkbox for all of these things. So I think in a culture of safety, we say, yep, we're making sure that we're doing that. If we look at the airline industry, if we look at the book, Cardiac Manifesto, what was that all about? Why are we doing timeouts in the OR? All these things are about a culture of safety. So I don't think it's a big question to even handwrite precordial used, visual monitoring of the chest rise and fall. If that's your ventilation monitoring, then that's it, I think. So I don't think it's a big thing to ask people to do.
Dr. Brady.
Yeah, I agree with that. Also, I think there's an element to not getting rid of this because the board has to have a way of investigating, right? So this is kind of a way for them to investigate that they're attesting that this took place.
Would someone give Jessica some guidance on how this should, letter H should read? And then Dr. Snell, I'll get to you.
So just kind of as a placeholder for now.
Dr. Hira?
Yep.
This is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General. You know, just to maybe help you frame it a little, that was an amazing discussion as far as, you know, the board's duty is always to regulate best minimum practices, right? It may not be what you would do, but as long as it meets the standard of care. And what it sounded like during that discussion was everybody really agreed that this is the minimum amount of diligence that you should do in this situation. So if that helps you frame it a little, I just thought that was a really good conversation legally.
Thanks, Seamus. Dr. Caputo?
Were you talking about H, are you saying, or were you talking about the list above in G?
We're talking about letter G, number one, A through G. Jessica is currently.
No, that's fine.
The only
comment I'll make, and it kind of carries forward on this concept of minimum necessary. You know, I think it's a real stretch to say when you have to do these things, preoperative, intraoperative, postoperative. I think we all get the intraoperative. I mean, that's not a huge stretch, but, you know, a large part of my patient population are adults with intellectual developmental disabilities. I'm not getting preoperative anything on them until I get them to a state that I can manage them. So I don't think that technically is a minimum then, because that would indicate that when I see that particular patient, I'm doing less than the minimum, right? And I don't think that's what you're trying to say. And to your point, and I think Jason's comment was perfect, you know, when the board goes to investigate these things, you know, we really struggle on the language. And we're having a discussion right now about the language regarding a permit holder and their role in the procedure based on the language of the regulation. So I think that's where you want to exercise your caution or your care, is if it's more restrictive, I think it's harder for folks to follow when they potentially didn't do anything wrong to begin with. So I think even just saying appropriate vital sign monitoring kind of gets around all of this, because we're all sort of saying that, and those determinations then will be made accordingly. Now, I realize you can split hairs, but gosh darn it, the more specific you get, it actually puts a greater level of challenge on the board when they make these kind of investigations. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Snell, you had your hand up and then down. Did you want to speak?
No.
Okay, Dr. Brady.
Yeah, I agree with Anthony on this. Actually, even looking at it, it can be very problematic. I mean, you know, sometimes if I was to look at this, I would have probably even strike the preoperative, intraoperative, postoperative, and just say pulse ox documentation. I mean, I guess, you know, some people are going to like abuse that, but as, especially the pre-op session, there's a lot of patients that you're not getting pre-op vitals on them for whatever circumstance that there is.
So suggestions on how to edit these rules. And we are in the midst of a discussion right now based off a motion, which we can always change. Dr. Arnold.
I just wanted to echo a little bit of the comments that have already been made. I too, you know, with pediatric patients, some of them are not able to cooperate for the preoperative vitals. Special needs patients, it's a big problem. If we're being required by by the law to get them. It's going to be a fist fight for some of them. And then, you know, I agree with everyone. I think everyone is on the same page that the primary mission of everyone involved in rewriting these rules is to increase safety. And there is, I believe, value in requiring a certain standard of care. There's value in requiring that certain things be in place to provide anesthesia. I think we should just remember that the act of creating the record does not make it safer for the patient. It's what we do for the patient that determines safety. But if we make a tremendously exhaustive list of everything that we have to record on our record, that doesn't actually produce increased safety for the patient. Sometimes it actually distracts the provider from paying attention to the patient. I'm not saying that H is tremendously exhaustive, but it does look like we're beginning the process of making an exhaustive list there in H. And I think just from like a regulatory point of view, we need to remember that it's not the creation of the record that brings safety, and we focus more on the requirements of having these things and less on the requirement of how we record how we use those things. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Arnold. Ollie?
To Dr. Arnold's point, I think it would be a wonderful world if we didn't have to document all this junk, because it can certainly be a distraction. But to Jessica with the language, I put it in the notes. I do, maybe for adding the ventilatory status, you could make it a new C. So just move everything down and just have it say intraoperative monitoring of ventilatory status utilizing capnography or precordial stethoscope. This is my suggestion for getting that language in there.
Thank you, Ali. Dr. Lau.
Yeah, I know American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, our sedation record has a section that says reason for not being able to obtain preoperative vital signs, obviously the pediatric population. Again, I'm tossing that out to the group. Do we want to make a line for that in case the intellectual disability patients that Dr. Caputo talked about, or the pediatric patients where you can't get preoperative vital signs? It's not a bad idea.
I think another consideration is we're under 1302. I mean, I'm sure the 1301 section has this also listed. And Jessica, we should probably look back and see what that they're consistent with each other, because the anesthesia record requirements would be the same. Dr. Snell?
I really appreciate what Dr. Arnall said. I apologize if I pronounced that incorrectly. And just hearing Dr. Lau adding one more thing, I get it. It's wonderful to have those things added, but I feel like we're just going down a hole of what we need to put in a record that is good to put in there. I'm not disagreeing that it's good to put in there, but is it really helping patient safety by adding the need to put all these into a record? I would venture to say that it doesn't. The requirement to have them is there. The requirement to put it in a record does not make patients more safe. And it's just a box. I get that. But now we're talking about adding another section where if we can't get it, we need to record that. Like, where does the rules stop for this list for our records? And I don't think this adds anything to patient safety to decrease the deaths and the adverse outcomes.
Is there a specific recommendation for this section with the rules then? I guess is what I would ask our committee. I mean, this section existed prior to this committee meeting. We were looking to add in the ventilatory monitoring, record keeping to make it consistent with what was already there. If none of this is needed, speak up and say it, and, you know, let's talk about it. But I think philosophically we're hearing a lot of good things. Let's kind of refocus on the specifics of this actual section. Ollie, and then, or Jessica, you want to go?
Oh, sure. I was just going to say, while I agree that, you know, part, if not the biggest majority of the board's responsibility is public safety, one of the other things that your rules do is regulate the professionals, right? And that regulation is what is supposed to ensure the safety of the public. And in adding this language or requiring this, these records, it gives you, the board, the ability to look back and ensure that the professional is operating in a safe manner. So I understand that having these things listed doesn't maybe directly relate to the safety of the public, but I think it does relate to the board's ability to ensure the safety.
Thank you, Jessica. Ollie and then Dr. Caputo.
That was a great point by Jessica. You know, in my mind, we had a pretty robust debate about whether 1302 permit holders should require capnography, right? And in the end, we decided, okay, in that setting, precordial seems acceptable. So what this documentation is doing is just making sure that the rules required get documented, right? And Dr. Hero brought up a good point that it should, you know, kind of mirror what's in 1301. And it does, except for this piece, because 1301 permit holders must use entitled CO2. So that's why I think it's important, this section, because we had a robust debate about whether precordial stethoscopes are acceptable. And what gets documented is simply a reflection of what we're saying is required. And to Jessica's point, making sure that it gets documented allows the board to regulate. So I think that it should be in there with that sentence that Jessica added is my stance on this.
Thank you. Susie, I'm going to let you jump in before Dr. Caputo. Susie, did you want to speak?
Sorry, I forgot to unmute myself. the other thing that it does is it gives the evaluators a list and a way to go back through so that one evaluator isn't saying, oh, well, in my practice, I always have, you know, ABC, la-di-da, you know, but he doesn't have that here, so he should have it. This kind of guide helps, I think, maybe, that it kind of helps the evaluators in having a list of A, B, C, D, E, F, G is required.
Thank you, Susie. Dr. Caputo, and then Sherry, I'm going to ask you for a roll call on the motion that's on the table, which, to repeat, is to adopt language, which is now G1C, intraoperative monitoring of ventilatory status utilizing capnography or precordial stethoscope. So go ahead, Dr. Caputo, and then Sherry, please take a vote. Roll call on the vote.
My advice would be to get rid of all of it. And I'll give you an example. You have there on F, indicate nothing by mouth or the last time of intake of food or water. That's meaningless for a moderate sedation. In fact, there's a lot of good literature out of emergency medicine that they don't even track that anymore because it's not an issue with respect to nausea and vomiting. And so you're just creating, and a few people have said this, you're creating a lot of work unnecessarily. And I can tell you, as an evaluator, I don't think this is helpful. I think you want appropriate monitoring for the level of sedation or anesthesia that you're administering, and that's where you should leave it. You're working too hard otherwise. So thank you.
Okay, Sherry, go ahead, please.
Hero?
Yes.
Bagai?
Am I voting yes to keep this?
The vote would be to adopt G1C, intraoperative monitoring of ventilatory status utilizing capnography or precordial stethoscope.
I vote yes.
Blazek?
Yes.
Brady? Dr. Brady?
Sorry about that. It took me a second. So, you know, I think my vote for this is yes, if we are going to keep all of these elements between A and H, and, you know, there may be a subsequent motion just to get rid of everything. But if we're keeping it, I think C is a yes.
That's kind of where I'm going with Dr. Brady. I think if this section is here, we need this language. If we're not going to have this section, that's where we're going. That's the next discussion.
Thanks for the clarification.
Brownstein? Dr. Brownstein? Christensen?
Yes.
Laut?
Yes.
Snell?
No.
Motion passes, one opposed. Okay, so what I said at the beginning, which is what I would go back to, if we're going to have this language here, for consistency's sake, I think we need to list the monitoring of ventilatory status, but let's have the discussion of if we need any of this listed out. And so I'll open it up to the committee. Go ahead, Dr. Brady.
Can we have one other discussion before that? Because we're talking about a global thing and right now we're talking about detail things. If we're still within the detail realms of things, I would make a motion to strike preoperative on A and B from that list that addresses the pediatric or uncooperative special needs type of situation.
Okay.
Or do something to adjust that.
There's a motion on the table. I'll second. We'll move to discussion. Susie, your hand is still up. Was that from before? Did you have something else to say?
No, I apologize.
No problem. Go ahead, Ollie.
Yeah. So to the point of erasing all of this, right?
I'm gonna just cut you off. Right now the motion is to strike preoperative from A and B. So let's just limit discussion to that. And then
gotcha. Okay. I thought we were talking about completely limiting section G.
No,
I have no problem eliminating preoperative in A and B. It makes a lot of sense. You get uncooperative and pediatric patients that you can't get all of that on. So no objection from me in doing that.
Dr. Brady, is the only edit you would make to just strike preoperative, or would you reword any other part of A and B?
I mean, we could follow like a notation with the AAPD. I just don't know, like, you know, the thing that confuses me with preoperative, what if someone was to argue, well, yeah, I have a preoperative blood pressure of when? 6 months ago, the day before, the day of service? There's a lot of gray area with it. I think as professionals, we're doing that. I think medical legally wise, it would come down to saying, well, you know, you didn't do this on a fit person or someone that had a cardiac disease issues. I mean, there's a lot of things that are in there. I mean, I get the AAPD has a sentence in there that kind of focuses on certain situations, but it goes a little bit further with me too. And that's why I made the motion just to strike that as opposed to adopting language as the AAPD has.
Any other discussion? Then Sherry, let's get a roll call.
Hero.
Yes.
Bagai.
Yes.
Lasik.
Yes.
Brady.
Yes.
Brownstein.
Yes.
Christensen.
Yes.
Laut.
Yes.
Snell.
Yes.
Motion passes, none opposed. Okay, now we'll open it back up to, do we want any of this in here? Go ahead, Dr. Brady.
I have a question. Are people in the audience allowed to make motions? Or is
no,
it only the committee?
Only committee.
It's only the committee. Okay, so just to recognize Caputo's point on the indication nothing by mouth or at the time of last intake, if we're still dealing with details, then I think that's worthy of a discussion. I'm not saying to make a motion at this point, but we should probably focus on that.
And I guess here's the other thing. I don't think we necessarily need to, and I mean, Seamus, you can correct me. We've made edits along the way without motioning and acceptance. I was doing that here because it wasn't clear what the committee member committee was agreeing upon. But I think we can just direct Jessica to make edits if it seems like we're all in agreement.
No, I absolutely agree. I think it could be much more fluid. Yes.
Yeah. My only purpose for doing that here was, at the beginning, was there was some disagreement, and I was trying to help us kind of refocus and keep moving along. But Ali, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I agree that there's, like, the NPO, there's probably some other things in here that can be tweaked, but maybe since there seems to be some sentiment of deleting the entire section, maybe we should make sure that we're going to keep the section before we tweak the section. So can we discuss whether we're keeping the section first and then talk about adjusting things like NPO status?
Yeah, I think that's on point.
And if I could continue, I'll just voice my opinion on it. I think, you know, I'm a person that doesn't think there should be overregulation, but while regulation is in place, it's there to keep patients safe and be able to regulate professionals. Having a record that shows that people are following the rules is laid out, as much as it would be great if we could just say, well, everyone's a professional. You know, you're going to do what's right, even if it's not documented. Well, that all sounds great until you get the guy that doesn't do it right and doesn't document it right either. You know, we could go down a slippery slope of, well, hey, if we don't need to document that we did things right, why have any of these rules at all? Everybody's a professional. Let's just go out and do our job. Let's have no rules at all. And we would have just spent, how long has it been? 3 years now of this committee, for nothing, just to have no regulation whatsoever. So my opinion is that if we are going to regulate, there needs to be documentation that people are doing what they say they're doing. And because of that, we do need this section G.
Dr. Brady, and then we'll go to you, Dr. Snell.
It is this like question I have, and I guess, you know, maybe someone can help me out with this, is if there's literature that's coming out, there's things that could be potentially changing. There's new monitors, this new gadget or widget that we find that's going to be added to patient safety, and we're having to go through rules and regs through this whole process for a line item change that could potentially impact patient safety. Couldn't we make this type of language into a pointer to the inspection form, and then the inspection form can be updated at times that is voted upon by the board and then sent out to everyone, so that at least you have more of a living document than a regiment document that's very, very hard to change for those types of aspects. And I guess to my point for that too is because if we're talking about NPO on F, I would say I haven't done my homework enough to make an opinion on that, and shame on me, maybe because I'm not living in modern sedation land so much. But you know, in GA, NPO is NPO, and that's what we're going by. So it's more of a broad brush question, and it really kind of directs how we take this. And I guess I'm asking broadly, is that something that's even acceptable to go in that type of manner where you have separate, more fluid, not in a fluid, but an ability for the board to make a change for something like that as they see fit?
Ryan, do you have comment on that?
I don't have anything to add.
Dr. Snell?
So I don't really have a problem leaving it there. It's been there forever. But I also wouldn't have a problem taking it out. You guys know that my stance on regulation stuff. To Ollie's point, you know, if we've regulated what people are supposed to have and how they're supposed to practice, and they don't document it and something happens, if the board comes back and says it'd be the same thing as a legal standpoint, and maybe this is a question for Ryan or for legal, wouldn't the board be able to say, show me evidence that you used a precordial stethoscope? And if they can't show you evidence, they would still be liable and held liable because the rules were that you have to have it. And if you don't document that you did have it and were using it, then if it, like Ollie said before, if you didn't write it, it didn't happen. So do we have to dictate what we write as far as our notes go from a safety standpoint to protect the public and to be able to regulate professionals?
So I'll just speak to my experience being on the board the last 4 years. It's a lot easier to appropriately regulate a licensee when there is a specific rule. So if we didn't have any of this and someone's in front of the board and they didn't document something, they'll provide studies that'll say, well, look, you don't need to write down the blood pressure during the case. And I've got 6 studies to show why that's not. And then there'll be a discussion about standard of care and what's the community doing and what do they think. And, you know, you kind of go round and round and then you'll make your vote. But if we're able to look and say, well, look, in our rule, it says you got to write down intraoperative pulse ox. It's a little easier to regulate them if they are not doing that. I do like Dr. Brady's suggestion of having something that is a little more fluid, but I guess I would ask how much of these items are really going to change anytime soon. I mean, is something going to come out where we're going to say, gosh, we don't have to record pulse ox anymore. That's great. We should have taken it out. But Dr. Brady, you got your hand up, so I'll let you go.
No, I mean, it just kind of goes along those lines. It's like, instead of like omitting the thing, is just saying that as indicated during your initial evaluation or during your evaluation. So we do evaluations every 5 years. And so that gives a 5-year window, which isn't incredibly too long, but it's also a dynamic enough to update that. You know, what they're being tested on is the expectation. That is the standard. That's what they're being challenged on every 5 years for these evaluations. And so it gives it that ability to still have the pointer and the reference when it comes to a board hearing, because you're pointing to those evaluations. I mean, that's just my thought. Like, if we're going to, I don't agree with just eliminating this, because then you eliminate the process of an investigation to point to things, for the boards to point to things.
Then my suggestion is that we move on.
I'm good with that.
I'm seeing some nodding.
Yes.
Dr. Sticking his head again. I'm just kidding. Go ahead, Jessica.
So I have 2 questions, I guess. It sounded like you guys are ready to move on and keep this section for now. That being said, when we add in documentation of intraoperative monitoring of ventilatory status, do you want it to match the first 2, A and B, with intraoperative and postoperative, and when it comes to the ventilatory status, we don't need the postoperative?
Matching's nice for my OCD. I think matching's good.
Okay. And then second, number 2, so this was all about G1, right? Now we get down to G2, which says basically that the records that they're keeping may include preoperative and postoperative electrocardiograph reports. If the record may or may not include this, do you need to say that at all? It's not necessarily a requirement. So I guess my question would be, what?
Right. The main.
Why?
Means
why
nothing.
Keep number 2? Yeah.
I would agree to take it out.
I'm just trying to go back. So because this is talking about the documentation, what did we decide? What is it? I'm just trying to scroll up on what I have open.
Under 1301, you are supposed to have it.
1301 has to have it, but does 1302 have to have EKG?
No. No. 1302 does not require, and I think we all know that just if you look at just the definitions alone, it would make it such that 1302 shouldn't be required to have electro ECG, EKG. The definition of moderate sedation, whereas the definition of deep sedation, general anesthesia, it makes sense to have that in there.
So number two, as it is now, is actually in the statutes, and I would make a motion that we remove it.
I second it. Lout seconds it.
Motion in a second. Any discussion?
Yeah, it doesn't even say under equipment that you have to have an EKG. So, yeah, I agree.
All right. All in favor?
Yes. Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes, none opposed.
Okay, so that then brings us down to H, and we had a comment, I believe, should this language be broader in terms of any adverse event?
Dr. Brady.
Yeah, and I think it should be consistent with all permit holders. So, it should be just to be broad. I mean, really what we're trying to report is hospitalizations, not really EMS. Calling them, but I think we've had this discussion before earlier. Can we just stay consistent for what we thought we had dialed in?
Ollie or Dr. Blazik, and then Ollie.
Yeah, I would agree with Jason that we should just, you know, cut and paste what we have in the 1301 permit. I know, you know, after talking to Dr. Germain many, many times, he has wanted us to create kind of a document like they have in the hospital where every single like thing is kind of tracked for patients. And I don't think we really need to do that in our realm. The important ones are when you have to activate EMS and things like that. If we start tracking these other items, then maybe there's an opportunity to go back and kind of look at how, you know, what IVs, you know, what's going on in the deep sedation, general anesthesia, IV world. But it's not the same as the hospital. So hence, I would not agree with his question about making it broader.
Ollie?
I agree we should keep language something like this. The one piece in this that I think shouldn't have to be document on records is having to put in a nasal trumpet or oral airway. I mean, I think if you have a patient with sleep apnea who's even just under light sedation, you might need a nasal trumpet, and it's not necessarily an adverse event to do that. So I would think include everything that's here except for removing the need for oral airway or nasal trumpet, because to me, that doesn't seem like an event, in my opinion.
Dr. Snell?
Just because the discussion was about copying and pasting, if you look back at 1301, it is copy and pasted exactly like this. So yeah. If we're going to stay consistent, we should probably be making sure we're making the edits in both of those sections, because this is word for word, except for 1302.
I'm not going to mention 1301, because in 1301, putting in an LMA or intubating or providing positive pressure ventilation, those things occur in lieu of it being an adverse event. They're often planned.
So the way I read this, though, it's just saying that needs to be recorded. You know, it says all adverse events and significant interventions. Now, maybe it's not a significant intervention.
It's not an intervention.
But it's just stating it needs to be recorded. So if you put in a nasal airway, you're writing that down on your anesthesia record.
Oh, good point.
Now, the one thing I would say is on a 1302 permit holder, it is an intervention if you're putting in any kind of oral airway, because you shouldn't be losing your airway to have to maintain it at this level of sedation anyway. So there's we could debate what's a significant intervention and what is not. And for a 1301 permit holder, intervening with an airway is not significant. For a 1302 permit holder, it would be significant. So with that said, my understanding of this is just saying you got to record it. not that you got to report it to the board or that it's, you know, anything comes of it other than you should write it in your record. Dr. Blazek, then Dr. Caputo.
Actually, Dr. Caputo had his hand up first. I'll defer to him.
Sorry about that. Dr. Caputo.
Thank you. I think you're working too hard here. How are you going to record a prolonged hospital admission? I mean, you're just trying to make, I just think there's just way too much going on here. I mean, and are you going to call it apnea just because my monitor said apnea, even though I corrected it? And I don't think this is helpful. I really don't. I don't think you want to go into this kind of detail. So thank you.
Yeah, that was going to be my comment to modify it. I think the words, you know, to you that we put such as, if we listed a couple and then said et cetera, then we'd leave it at that. We don't have to be so, like mandatory on it. I'm not sure if a statute can be written that way, that we leave things up for et cetera. But I would be in favor of shortening this H section, you know, to the event of, or to some of the effect of the permit holder maintains records that track adverse events or interventions, period, and just leave it like that.
Aren't we required? I mean, in another section, if you have an adverse event, you have to notify the board and you have to document it. So do we even need this here at all? Jessica, you got your hand up.
No, actually, I was just going to kind of second what the other folks have said about you can't really put et cetera into the rules. It's not proper rule form. If you didn't want to list, and I don't recommend trying to list every type of adverse event, I think the more appropriate way to handle this would be to, like someone said, end it at significant interventions, period.
And it does somewhat. Here, just before I go back to you guys, Dr. Caputo and Dr. Blazek, R411-1305 reports of adverse occurrences, it states, if a death or incident requiring emergency medical response occurs in a dental office or dental clinic during the administration or recovery from general anesthesia, deep sedation, moderate sedation, or minimal sedation, the permit holder and the treating dentist involved shall submit a complete record of the incident to the board within 10 days after the occurrence. So, in my mind, we're already kind of addressing this in another section. So I'm not sure any of it's needed, but I don't know who had their hand up, Dr. Blazek and then Dr. Caputo.
I was just going to mention when we do the evaluation, there is a section on the evaluation that indicates, this is mostly for the 1301 permits, I remember, that there's a section for them to indicate any interventions or adverse events as we go through the evaluation form. So we're supposed to make sure that the anesthetic record has a spot for that. But anyhow, I mean, I'm kind of indifferent to it based on what the rules and regulations state. I could go without it, but if we keep it, I would make it short.
Dr. Caputo.
Thanks. I just want to, and I think you guys all know this, but sometimes we use words interchangeably. These are not statutes. These are just rules. And statutes are much harder to change, obviously. Has to go through the legislature, but you're changing rules right now, which is a different process. But I don't think you need this, and I don't think it's going to be easy to assess anyway. And I find that a challenge because if someone didn't write it down, how would you know? So I have laryngospasms occasionally. I don't write them down. Well, you would never know it if it's not in my record. So I don't know the implication there. And then I don't know how that affects anything anyway. So I just think you're asking for something that would be hard to do in the first place. Thank
Jessica.
You.
Jessica.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think if you do decide to keep this language, then I think some of the hurdles you're going to have is, you know, you've listed specifically before, we just went through that discussion of what the records need to include. And yet when you talk about records of adverse events, you're using the word track. What does track mean? Does it mean that you're recording certain things, you know, within that adverse event? And then furthermore, you're talking about significant interventions. What is the difference between a significant versus an insignificant intervention? Or do you want all interventions? And then thirdly, the fact that you did mention that your rules already address this, I would lean towards this would be redundant.
Then I think we should remove it. Dr. Blazek, you got your hand up.
I was going to make a motion to remove Section H.
I don't even think we need a motion. Let's just remove it, Jessica.
Okay.
Can I just add in for Jessica's sake, you might want to go back and, or since it's already in the rules, go back to Section 1301 and remove the same verbiage.
Agreed.
Because it's in, we went by 1301 and we left it in there.
Will do.
And this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. I just wanted to ensure. So basically, Dr. Hero, you are just noting all this. Jessica's noting all this. At the end, you'll make a motion to accept the changes as amended, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and this wasn't part of the original rules. This is something I think Dr. German maybe wrote.
Correct.
Great. Well, let's move along then, Jessica.
Okay. That brings us to subsection I. The section 1302 permit holder shall use, oh boy, I'm going to butcher this, intraosseous access exclusively for emergency situations.
You nailed it, Jessica.
Good job, Jessica.
Woo-hoo. Thanks, guys. That's a new section, but I think it tracks with what we did in 1301, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to assume that we're all good with that, and that'll bring us to
subsection. Dr. Arnell, do you have a comment?
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Hero. I bet you could see this comment coming. Anybody that knows me knows that I have researched IOs to the ends of the earth, and so I won't go into a long discussion about it. But I do find this to be a unique thing in the rules to say that a certain procedure cannot be used, and this is a procedure that it has wide acceptance across many professions and has been used for over 100 years. I feel that this is in here because out of tradition, dentists tend to fear something that they have not been trained to do and that does not involve the mouth. But I think there's a problem with looking at a procedure and saying that can't be done without first researching it, and to start limiting procedures that are life-saving procedures by law. And again, I shouldn't get into a long discussion here, but I have not just a few articles, dozens and dozens and dozens of articles that talk about how this should be considered a first line tool for vascular access, especially in the pediatric environment. And the pediatric physicians are putting a very heavy push toward having this being considered the first line in pediatric setting. So I would say we would actually be decreasing safety by making providers in our state feel that there's limits on using this when necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Blazek, then Ali.
My point, and Dr. Arnell, I appreciate the input, but I think the way we read this and took this was, if you have a patient that you need intraosseous access, probably not best to be doing it in your office. And I think that's how we looked at this and why we made that suggestion, not only for the 02 permit, but for the 01 permit. So that was the background on that section.
Thank you, Dr. Blazek. Ali?
Yeah, I was just going to add a little more to that. This committee became aware of routine elective use of intraosseous access when intravenous access was difficult. 100% agree, intraosseous access is a great way to administer fluid and medications in the event of an emergency when you can't get intravenous access. But if you have an awake patient that you just so desperately need to get the procedure done that you're going to access IO, that's the problem. So that's where this additional language came from, was so people aren't routinely using intraosseous access.
Thanks. go ahead, Dr. Arnold. I'm going to just ask you to keep it short so we don't get into too much of a discussion in the weeds on this.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I agree, Ali. I would not use this on an awake patient. I think this is something that is extremely valuable for a gas induction on a pediatric patient. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, doctor. Go ahead, Jessica. Let's keep us moving.
Okay, so that brings us down to J, the section 1302 permit holder for intravenous access shall use a new infusion set, including a new infusion line and new bag of fluid for each patient. Again, I think that tracks with what we did in 1301. Moving on to subsection K, the 1302 permit holder shall utilize supplemental oxygen for patients receiving moderate sedation for duration of the procedure. Don't think there's anything crazy going on there. Brings us to subsections L and M. There was a question here. What are the guidelines for discharge? None are listed.
That's from Dr. German again, I think. And I know we have rewritten the guidelines for the 1301 permit. I thought they were pretty general. I might suggest we cut and paste those either in section M or if it has to be a new section, I'm not sure.
Dr. Brady?
Yeah, the question about oxygen is just to play devil's advocate. Let's say you're doing a moderate sedation on a patient and they start experiencing chest pain, new chest pain, never had chest pain before. ACLS is going to tell you to titrate oxygen, in fact, not give oxygen if they have high saturation levels because it can make the infarct even bigger. So, and they're already under sedation, and part of treating acute coronary syndrome is also to administer sedative drugs. So I can see where, like, okay, just to play devil's advocate, may not be appropriate.
Dr. Snow?
I don't think you're playing devil's advocate at all. That's a topic that I've discussed with a lot of individuals in the moderate sedation world, the wonder of to why. I mean, I think the intent is that we all know, we're familiar with the studies, when you pre-oxygenate, if you have apneic event, you get more time to, but I, in a moderate sedation.
There's a whole reason why ACLS says not to give oxygen. It's like in their algorithm. You're literally going against what the AHA is saying.
I don't disagree. I completely 100% agree with you.
I just think oxygen is a titratable thing for K. I get it. Like, yeah, you should be giving oxygen to the vast majority of people, but I just think there's a little bit more details into that that can get someone kind of in a circular issue.
Do you think that should be removed then?
Dr. Brady, I don't have a problem with it being removed it's kind of a situational thing, right? It's like someone needs, if they're looking at this, it's like, okay, why aren't you giving oxygen to a hypoxic patient? Absolutely.
Jessica?
So correct me if I'm wrong. I think you're discussing subsection K about the supplemental oxygen. And what I'm hearing is that in some situations you do want to give them oxygen, and in some situations you shouldn't. And this, because it's a shall, kind of makes it sound like they should always be giving them oxygen. So to kind of meet in the middle, we could just tack on if necessary at the end. Essentially, they shall utilize supplemental oxygen for patients receiving moderate sedation for the duration of the procedure as necessary.
Ollie?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, I think Dr. Brady brings up a great point. My concern in deleting it would be now people don't have oxygen available, right? But I think what Jessica added is great. But yeah, as it's written, I mean, gosh, you got to turn the oxygen off for sure during certain times in a procedure, as we're all well aware of. So yeah, I think Jessica's
airway fire, right? You're not supposed to have oxygen with the laser. That's another example.
I wasn't going to directly say it, but yes, that's it. So, but if, do we need to keep shall? Should it be may? May utilize, may use supplement, you know, should it not be shall? Or does the shall not really matter if you add as necessary?
Jessica.
Yeah, this is Jessica. So if you take out the shall and you make it a may, you might as well not have it in there.
Okay.
Because then you're not, the rules are supposed to provide requirements. And if it's a may, then it's not a requirement.
I think as necessary is appropriate. I think that addresses my concern.
Great. Or should it be as appropriate?
Keith?
So Ali brings up a good point about, and I was trying to look and I didn't finish looking here, is, oh yeah, it is. So Ali, when you say, you know, you're worried about people not having oxygen if it's not mandated to use it. One of, if you go back to section D of 1302, D2A, that's one of the things that people have to have is positive pressure oxygen and supplemental oxygen. So just because we're not mandating that they use it all time, every time, they still have to have it in case of an emergency, and that part of their inspection is that they prove that. In fact, it's one of the, on the inspection form, we have to pull the serial number from the oxygen devices and list it. So
I think the as necessary addresses a lot of this. So my opinion would be let's move forward.
Okay. So back to L and M, about supervising the patient from initiation of moderate sedation until termination of the procedure, and oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable. Just making sure there's no other issues or discussion on that. We just want to make sure that it tracks the same language that's in 1301. If that is the case, then we come down to section 1301.
I just was going to, you know, kind of jump in where you guys were talking about the guidelines for discharge and kind of wondering what those might be. And I think kind of in concert with a lot of the discussion that's been going on about some of the details, what if you just said until the patient is in monitored recovery or discharged? And then you don't have to worry about someone knowing what those guidelines are or wondering what they are, trying to elucidate what they are. Basically, really what the point of M is that the dentist should not be treating more than one patient at a time. That's effectively what the intention of the section is. So what you're saying then is that the patient that they've just seen, if they have another patient scheduled, is in a monitored recovery situation or discharged. So that might help you in trying to work that out. Thank you.
Thank you. Jessica, you got your hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to, from what I recall, this language was also put into 1301, and the issue there was that you didn't want to go into, you know, specific details about what the discharge guidelines should be, but that you did want the doctors to have a set guideline for discharging their patients so that it was consistent from one patient to the next. And I think that's how you ended up with the, you know, shall establish written guidelines for discharging a patient, making sure that they have some sort of guidelines, regardless of what they determine those guidelines should be.
Ali?
Yeah, that's what I thought too, Jessica. I'm trying to find it, though, because I thought we put somewhere above in the section that they shall establish guidelines for discharge. And that's what that's referring to in that piece. But I'm having trouble.
So, in subsection N, it's highlighted on my screen if you can see it. It says that the section 1302 permit holder shall establish written guidelines for discharging a patient.
Yeah, so there you go. They just have to meet their own guidelines for discharge they've established, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Caputo.
All right, so I just think it's redundant. I mean, if you have N, then if they have to have established guidelines, then what does it matter that they meet the guidelines? You're just discharging them because you're already assuming by virtue of what you wrote in N that they had those established guidelines for discharge. So I just think you're working too hard. Obviously, it's not a huge deal, but really the point of M is that the dentist should not be treating more than one patient if they're the ones that is administering anesthesia or sedation to their patients. So anyway, thank you.
Ali?
I agree with Dr. Caputo that we are all working too hard, that's for sure. But to this point, I think one piece is talking about the spectrum of supervising the patient, and this other section is saying what the guidelines are. So it's just what we're looking at now is you're monitoring from, you know, here to here, and the endpoint being the guidelines that you've already established. So in my opinion, you keep both, but neither really needs to be changed from what they are currently. But we're definitely working too hard. Not just in this committee, you know, since all of us are people who work too hard. That's why we've signed up for this committee.
So I'm thinking we're okay with L and M and N.
I think we're okay.
Okay. That will take us to O. And we did have a comment here. So there was language added, I think, by Dr. Begay, and then Dr. Snell had a comment to it. So a section 1302 permit holder may employ or work with an anesthesia or sedation provider that qualifies under 1304 to provide anesthesia or sedation services with the limitations outlined in 1304 and shall ensure that the healthcare professional continuously supervises the patient from the administration of anesthesia or sedation until termination of the anesthesia or sedation procedure and oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable. The comment from Dr. Snow, I'm okay with this verbiage, but the R4 sections mentioned here may need to be changed.
Ali?
Yeah, so just to give intent to this language, this is basically to allow the permit holder, when they're bringing in a CRNA or anesthesiologist, to delegate to that provider to be responsible for the monitoring. If I'm reading it again, the fact that it says supervise in the prior section, it doesn't say direct supervision. So this may be unnecessary and redundant, but that was the intent here, was that the permit holder who brings in, you know, an outside anesthesia provider or a non-permitted, non-dentist anesthesia provider could delegate the monitoring responsibility to that person.
I mean, I wonder if we even need this here. I mean,
that's what I was saying. Since supervision above isn't defined as direct supervision or direct observation, it may not be necessary. It just makes it, the intent was to make it clear that the permit holding dentist who brings someone else in can delegate that responsibility.
So is the committee okay if we remove it?
Yeah, you can remove it.
Okay, give me one second. Okay. So do you want to remove section O completely, or do you want to keep what was already there?
Well, Jessica, I think we discussed this a while ago. I mean, probably like 2 years ago. And I want to say you recommended that we do list that a 1302 permit holder may employ or work with an anesthesia provider. But I don't know if that needed to be listed here or under the 1304 that a 1301 or 2 or 3 provider does not need a 1304 permit to work with another non-dental anesthesia provider. So at somewhere, it probably needs to state that a 1302 permit holder can work with a non-dentist anesthesia provider, but I don't know if that would be here or in the 04 section. Ollie?
And my suggestion would be to not put the carriage before the horse and keep this the way that it was before this change. And then, yeah, I think it totally makes sense to, if rather than having all the redundancies and all the sections, just in 1304, it listed that 1301, 2, or 3 could employ or work with. But for the time being, until we change that, I think I'd be more comfortable if we keep it in there so that it's clear that a 1302 permit holder may do that.
Okay, so I guess what I'm hearing is keep this language, the updated language, until we get to 1304, and then we may end up coming back and changing this based on what happens in 1304.
Or just keep the original language.
Yeah, but I think it's muddled because it's not just the some stuff that's not lined out and not separated was part of the original language. I just can't remember where it ended in the original rule.
I thought it was just pretty, it was just say, may employer work with an anesthesia or sedation provider that qualifies under lengthy blank blank to provide anesthesia or sedation services with limited. I thought it ended after that.
Maybe it did. But then why is a healthcare professional as specified in R411-1301 lined out?
At the bottom. Maybe that should be, yeah. I don't know. Where's the original document?
The original language is a section 1302 permit holder may employ or work with a healthcare professional as specified in R411-1301I.
Oh, so it was just anything that's in red and not lined out was new. So that could all be deleted and a healthcare professional as specified not be lined out. Have that go back to be part of it.
Okay.
I wonder if R411-1301I is still an accurate reference.
It is probably not an accurate reference.
No, it's not. It's now O.
Sorry, guys, I think my computer's lagging. And then that brings us down to the 1302P language, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think we already addressed this by mirroring what we did in 1301, which is pretty much adding all of this into a new subsection C at the beginning of this rule. and none of this is necessary anymore.
Dr. Blazek?
That's just what I was going to say, because it's not accurate. It doesn't mirror what we had before. So that was it.
Okay.
But what do we need for the, do we just want to mirror what's in 1301 for the 1302P?
We have.
Oh, we already did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Buda?
I just am curious, and I don't understand why we do this at this level, but what happens with a patient who's at a level of deep sedation or general anesthesia is very different than moderate sedation. And I don't understand the mirroring. I don't know that you're gaining any increased safety. I think you're just creating undue burden. It really doesn't make sense to me. I'd love for someone to explain to me, just as an example, how someone who has PALS is better off recovering somebody versus someone who does not. I just don't see any, and I'd love to see the evidence that demonstrates that that person's more or less safe than someone else. I don't know why the mirroring has to occur. I think you can define appropriate guidelines based on the level of sedation or anesthesia versus just doing the same thing. So thank you.
We're trying to make less work for ourselves.
Dr. Brady, do you care to comment? Because I know this is pretty much your section here.
Well, I think this is Lau. I think when we were doing this, Dr. German had some comments as well regarding the pediatric population. And I think that's why we went with the PALS for that sake. Is it ideal? No, but it's the best we got. And I think if you got some people that are moderate sedation holders that aren't real familiar with working with pediatrics, I think we have to have something like this in there.
Well, I would think also, Dr. Lau, one of the issues we had here, and it was brought up probably in the second or third meeting, is we were trying to establish some type of criteria that prevented the general dentist who took a few weekend courses on IV sedation to start doing pediatrics.
Right.
That is the gist of this entire pediatric designation, which I do believe is a good move. And if we want to break it down into the recovery aspect, and I'm not really sure what I'm reading right now, if what I have here is what we're going to try to pass or not, I'd have to go back to 1301, I think, to be accurate. But that's the real impetus here, Dr. Caputo, was that we were trying to moderate or have an idea about who's really giving even sedation to pediatric patients, because we feel that that's something that needs to be a little bit tighter than it has been in the past.
Dr. Brady?
Thank you. That's exactly what I was going to say. So I put my hand down, but really to echo that thought, there is a difference. And really we're trying to look at for that pediatric endorsement is educational requirements, continuity of treating that patient population and what those standards are at. So it harmonizes. And I think that we need to stick with that.
Dr. Caputo.
Well, if this is the new language that's more consistent, what you guys have in 1301, this is better. At least you have some oars in there. So unless you moved, it looks like, did you guys remove it? Is that what happened? What just happened with what was up there?
I think also it's important to remember we're talking about IV moderate sedation on an 8-year-old or younger. I just don't think there's that many providers that are, I don't even think there's that many patients that are 6-7 years old that are going to sit for an IV and then sit for moderate sedation. So.
Oh, I completely agree. But that's what this term, but it looks like the language changed. So maybe I'm just, I brought up something unnecessarily. My apologies.
And to go with what Dr. Blasek said, we do have some verbiage in there about taking what's the minimum educational requirements to be able to do this. So that's for the pediatric patients. So we do have some language in there for that reason.
Yeah, I think it's important to have it. With that said, I don't think it's going to really be, it's going to impact that many existing providers, which is probably a good thing because I just don't think there's that many providers doing that. Go ahead, Dr. Snell.
It's okay. You just said it. We're good.
Yeah, Heath, I don't think you're going around IV sedating five-year-olds right now.
But that does bring up, and that's why I actually agree with Dr. Caputo quite heavily with this idea of mirroring that has been said throughout many of the, I won't say statutes, sorry, Dr. Caputo, the rules that we're doing here. I hear that often. I heard it back in 2013 when they were changing it. Well, it needs to mirror. I'm like, we're doing completely different sedations. Like, for example, I'll go back to my capnography thing. It's completely different from moderate sedation than it is mild or deep sedation. Oxygen is completely different, but we need to mirror. We need to be consistent. So from that standpoint, I totally agree. But with regards to the pediatric section here, I don't read anything in this particular section of the 1302, although while it is mirrored, quote unquote, I think it's all necessary and good and fine. And I don't have any issue with what's there for the 1302.
Great, thank you. Well, as we approach the 1303, I think that's going to be a good stopping point. Unless this committee wants to continue to.
I vote to continue till 5. I say this every time, but we don't drive. The less we have to meet, the more we've done in each session, the less time I have to take off of work. But I might be in minority in that viewpoint.
Dr. Caputo, you've got your hand up.
Well, since it's almost 6:30 for me, I think it can end any time. But, I will say something, and honestly, I'd love to hear Jason's comment on this, on my comment. But going back to what Dr. Lout mentioned about PALS, and that's what we have. First of all, I think I've told you guys before, I think that ACLS and PALS are worthless for what we do. I just think we should throw it away. What I do think is important, though, because we do have something, and that is simulation. And I think training in simulation, particularly in the area of airway management, which our rules allow, is really something maybe we should work more steadfastly towards. Because to me, understanding how to manage the airway is not going to be taught in ACLS or PALS. They get taught how to put a tube in on a mannequin, and it's not done very well. But understanding how to manage an airway appropriately is a whole different thing. And I do think there's a place for it. I don't know if it's practical because of cost. I don't know if it's practical for other reasons as well. But, I mean, I know Jason has a lot of background with simulation, and he understands the process well and has even been involved with it at different levels. But I really think that's what we have, and we should try to work towards that more for preparing dentists in managing patients at a higher level versus thinking all we have is ACLS or PALS. So I think it's a fun discussion that has application, and I certainly don't want to take time away, particularly if you guys want to continue, but maybe it's a good stopping point discussion to have. But I just appreciate the opportunity just to say that. Thanks.
Thanks. Dr. Brady?
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you, Anthony. I think simulation is a big factor. In fact, and thanks for kind of shouting that out, because I'm very involved with simulation. I've been for, 8 years, the co-director for SIM for the ADSA. And it is something that we have discussed. I think that when it comes down to the PALS certification, and I don't want to misspeak because he's not here, but
Jason, you cut yourself off of the audio.
Oh, sorry. I'm using the space bar function to unmute, but it's glitching, so I'll just do it the old-fashioned way. Essentially, what it comes down to is simulation is absolutely important, and we talked about even increasing the amount of the requirements with simulation being involved as one of the components. But the PALS, as we have looked at this, is addressing crisis management for the pediatric patient, and where simulation, a lot of that high fidelity simulation is going to be more for older population, which is somewhat different too. I mean, I wish there was more like pediatric simulation to take on to this. And that's kind of where the committee came up with this. But I recognize the value of airway, the value of those courses. And there are also other courses out there as well. But we pinned down PALS as being focused on peds, focus on advanced cardiac life support for that purpose. But yeah, there are other options to consider as well.
Great, thank you. Jessica, where are we right now?
You are two sections away from being done with 1302.
Great, let's hammer those out, and I'm gonna suggest we end after that. Go ahead.
Okay, so you're on subsection Q. If the section 1302 permit holder who administers moderate sedation to a patient is the operating dentist, the section 1302 permit holder shall ensure there is a person present with the patient during the critical portion of the procedure whose primary responsibility is to monitor the patient during the procedure and, one, has a current certification in PALS if the patient is pediatric, or, two, has current certification in ACLS. The question that I had here is, does the auxiliary staff need to have current certification in a board-approved training program for such monitoring?
Dr. Blazek?
I would say no to that. And that what we're trying to do, I would think, is the PALS and the ACLS is where that's where we're trying to make the auxiliary staff, you know, have some training. That's what it is right there.
Dr. Snow.
So let me, I was trying to understand, you guys can help me. So this is saying that if I'm providing this patient and the and doing work, one of my staff has to have PALS or ACLS.
Isn't this just for pediatric? That's what I'm confused too, to be honest.
I think this was copied from the 1301 section. I don't remember this being in here, Jessica, until just like 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago.
That's correct. So this language is mirroring what was in 1301.
So I don't think that's necessary for a 1302.
Right. Yeah, Q should be removed.
Q should be removed or all of Q?
Q.
All of Q.
Okay.
Dr. Caputo?
I'm just curious, and I apologize if this is something you guys already know, but what exactly is the critical portion of the procedure? I don't know what that means.
The whole thing. Yeah, you're right. This whole section really needs to be reworked to apply to 1302. I mean, it's talking about, you know, deep sedation, general anesthesia. We probably need to really rework this
reword
section for a 1302P. It really needs to be reworked. But is there?
So this is just relating to a 1302 permit, not a 1302 permit holder who also has a pediatric endorsement.
Section R is written now.
Sorry, let me rephrase that. Q.
Yeah, so Q needs to be removed. Yeah, I think Q should be taken out for 1302. But even the current section R, as it's been pasted in here, I think needs to be significantly edited to be kept in the 1302 section.
Well, you got to take the general anesthesia and deep sedation out.
But even if you do that, I understand. But what is the critical portion of the procedure? I just don't understand what that means.
I think it should say critical portion of the anesthetic. which would be the entire time the patient's asleep. And then when the patient's in recovery, if you have someone who is, you know, qualified to recover the patient, then that's what would be okay. I think that's what's meant.
The one thing with Dr. Blazek is I've always been told that 1302 patients should not be asleep.
Well, and I mean, I think we need to define, to Dr. Caputo's point, frankly, what the critical portion is, because I assume that was induction and recovery, the beginning of recovery for the 1301 permit holder. So I guess I'm a little confused on how this fits for the 1302 permit as well.
All right, you guys got work to do. Thank you.
In the hospital, a medical anesthesiologist is necessarily to be present when a CRNA puts the patient to upon induction.
No.
And no. On wake up, from what I've seen.
That's false.
Then maybe what we should do is work on rewording this outside the meeting, get it to Jessica, and just launch off here at our next meeting. How's that sound?
I support that.
What I would request is that if Jessica could, you know, when she sends out the, can this be sent out to us, you know, right away, and then we can, as opposed to, what is it, like 10 days prior to the meeting, or what we seem to be getting all of our information, and then we can just go through and just wordsmith. I mean, most of this is just kind of wordsmithing, making it more applicable.
Is that something we could do, Ryan?
I can probably get you guys an updated copy over to board staff no later than Monday.
Yeah, so we can send it 2 weeks prior to your meeting, just because there's more to the agenda than just this. But when we get an update from her, we can send it so you guys can work on it.
Great, thank you. Then with that said, I think we adjourn this meeting.
Wait, sorry, do you want to cover some of the other topics that you had on the agenda? Like, we still are at 10 members. I don't know if that's been on the agenda a couple of times.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the only one to discuss. Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's been less of an issue getting a quorum, and that was what was kind of guiding it. We still could appoint somebody. Jason, you want to go ahead?
I apologize. I do have to get off the call at this point. So if we still have a quorum, or if I need to make adjustments, if we're crunching through this, I think too. I mean, I know there's a lot of work in this, but really, my mind is really, really narrow. Having the 2-hour windows for me fits perfect. Leading it to past 2 hours doesn't necessarily work really well for me, but I mean, it's just me individually. I'm sorry, but you know, if I'm holding the quorum, it's just for planning for today and for future meetings, that we can have like a 2-hour window of expectation, or if it needs to be adjusted to 3, I just need to know what those expectations are.
Thank you, Dr. Brady, and you're not breaking our quorum, so we're good.
All right, thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
I need to go as well, but I'm going to switch over to my phone. I'll just call him from my phone.
So if we were going to hit another agenda item, I'd look at number 5, Anesthesia and Intravenous Sedation Committee, appointing another person. But I guess I'd like to hear from the committee members. I mean, originally we had 11. One was a public member, Mr. Goodman, who sits on the dental board. He requested to be off. Jessica, go ahead.
Sorry, if you guys you don't need me for this part of the meeting, correct? We're done with the notice of proposal. Okay. Sorry, I just didn't want to keep you guys. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. Appreciate all you do. Mm-hmm. So the idea was we went from an 11-person committee to a 10-person committee. We have had quorum challenges, so we thought appointing another person to go back to 11 might help with those quorum issues. Heath?
Thank you.
I don't know where we are with numbers, Anthony. You probably know better than Ryan. But it is, I feel the frustration of Yasmin when she would send those out, that it's frustrating when it's on our calendars. I think for everyone, we don't have patients scheduled because it's coming up, and then 3 days before we need to cancel because there's not a quorum. So if we need more members to help that, because we all have things that come up, and I understand that, then I would vote to put more on so that we can have a quorum more easily. Or if we're doing just fine with what's there, we don't need it, but it is terribly frustrating when something gets canceled just a couple days before.
Thanks. I agree. Ryan?
Yeah, if I can, and I don't want to belabor the meeting, but I would echo Dr. Snell's comments that I think that the biggest, it's frustrating for staff, but I think it's a bigger frustration for the folks that planned on meeting and then it was canceled because last minute we didn't have a quorum. With 10 or 11, your quorum is met at 6. So I think since your quorum is at 6, I would definitely increase to 11 or drop from 10 to 9, which means you got to get rid of somebody to lower your quorum to 5. But because you have people that want to volunteer to make it 11, I think, I'll say 20 names on your agenda today of people that have volunteered to say they want to finish out this committee. It might just be best if you go with that. But again, to reiterate my point, because your quorum is the same at 10 and 11, it's better to increase it to 11 so you don't run into those troubles as often.
Thank you, Ryan. I think the only challenge in appointing somebody would be, we've been going at this for 3 years now. To bring somebody in new could pose a challenge. But with that said, Dr. Arnell and Dr. Caputo have been pretty engaged from the beginning. So I think either one of them would make a great addition. Go ahead, Dr. Blazing.
I'm probably the outlier. I don't think you add anybody, with all due respect to Dr. Arnell and Dr. Caputo. And everyone just put your big boy pants on and you get here to the meetings. That's my two cents.
Thanks, Dr. Blazing. Any other input from other committee members? Dr. Snell?
Anthony, this is maybe just what's appropriate and what's not, or what we can do, what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do. The original committee was set up by the dental board, by the president of the dental board. Is it within our purview to appoint someone, or does that have to come from the dental board like it originally did?
You're right, Keith. The previous board president picked this committee, formulated and picked this committee. My understanding, Ryan, if you want to jump in, or Seamus, this committee does have the ability to decide to appoint another member or not. Is that right, Ryan?
Mostly. You guys would make the recommendation and then the board would still approve the recommendation. I think it would be kind of a rubber stamp because you guys would be the ones to select. They might just say, okay, but that's how the process would work.
Great. Dr. Christensen, Dr. Lau,
agreed.
Do you have an opinion on? Keeping it at 10.
I tend to concur with Dr. Blazek said. Just stick with the committee. We're all in this deep. We know what's going on. Introduce somebody else would be kind of challenging, I think, at this point. And people just have to be committed to make the meetings.
Yeah, this is Christensen. I think we just move forward with where we're at and let's get this thing done.
Dr.
Snell. I appreciate everybody's input, though, for sure.
Heath, yeah, your hand up.
I think a lot of the frustration from the board staff and maybe for myself is the last minute cancellations as well. Like if people give a heads up when Yasmin sends it out, hey, RSVP, and we RSVP that we're going to be there, if we can see a month out that we're not going to be there, I think we all can at that point reorganize schedules. But it's when we have a committee formed and then 2 days before or the day of, all of a sudden there's no more committee. That's when I think is the most frustrating. So if we just try to commit, like Dr. Lee said, and and give those RSVPs ahead of time and stick to it, I think all this kind of goes by the wayside.
I think all that's well said. My opinion, I'm indifferent. I mean, I would echo the frustration with the cancellations because of a lack of a quorum, but I would really defer to what the committee wants to do, and I'll, you know, my support will lie with what you guys want. So what I'm hearing is let's just press forward and all just make a commitment to be here, you know, when we say we're going to be here.
I like it.
Great. Then if there's nothing else, Ryan, I'm going to adjourn. All right. Appreciate it, everybody. We're going to adjourn the meeting, and we'll see you guys next time. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.